So last week we spent some time in the coffee houses of London in the 18th century. This week we're reading the work of a man who's spent more than 30 years of his life in London in the century following. He moved permanently to England in 1849, having been exiled because of his revolutionary political activities from his native Germany, as well as from France and Belgium. And much of his time in London was spent in the British Library, the reading room, sorry, of the British Museum, as it now is. So this is the British Library then, now British Museum, and in fact Marx's seat there. The library obviously no longer looks like that, but he had that reserved seat. Nowadays in the museum or in the library, you can't reserve seats, so that you would you have just first come, first serve now. That's where he researched Capital, the book we're reading today. First volume was published in 1867. Marx died in 1881. Two more volumes were published, as well as a large set of notes that he prepared for a fourth volume, but never got to publishing. His aim in Capital, as David Harvey explains, is to understand how capitalism works by way of a critique of political economy. That's what Harvey says. Marx classifies modern society as capitalist, and just to go over a couple of elementary points about what that means for him. Production for sale rather than direct use. This is a crucial point that we'll come back to. The strategy underlying production of commodities is to sell them, obviously, so that you're not making goods simply to be used in the way in which, in let's say, in barter-based societies, you would previously have been. So then the second feature is the mediation of exchange by money, something that obviously occurs historically, but by the time that Marx is writing, even a couple of centuries maybe before that. So I say more or less universal mediation, because it's very obvious that some forms of production of goods, of commodities, takes place outside of the mediation of exchange, and it's clear, isn't it, that for some people engaged in production, I'm thinking particularly of artists of some kind, there seems to be some sort of vested interest in actually producing things that do not go to market. So musicians, for instance, who want their works to be distributed outside of exchange. Poets who will write for designated specific readers and will actually then distribute their works themselves, etc. So private ownership here of the production process and financial decision making in the hands of a particular social class, competition between capitals, very obviously. I was just hearing this morning that whereas before, obviously Hollywood has long been an oligopoly, but in fact that oligopoly is shrinking. It used to be six major production firms who make most of the films that we see. It's about to be only three. So that sense of concentration, fierce concentration, often leading to a concentration, and the existence then of a market where labour power is bought and sold. Free wage labour, I put the free in quotes because, of course, although you are not compelled to participate in the marketplace, so this is not slavery, but on the other hand, the fact that you need to make money in order to live more or less compels you there. So, of course, goods can be exchanged on the market. So there's some obvious features, but not, but nevertheless, maybe worth spelling out for us. In capitalist society, Marx says the capitalist mode of production predominates. And I mention that point because it's also obvious that in capitalist societies, other modes of production also exist. Most notably, I suppose, the question of what happens to pre-capitalist modes of production in capitalist society. And it's obvious they don't just disappear. Although capitalism does tend to, as it spreads and as it intensifies, as it deepens, most forms of production tend to become capitalist ones. But there still are obviously significant survivals of earlier modes of production, which continue to exist meaningfully alongside capitalist ones in a capitalist society. We'll come back to this question much more often. So when you think of the point that you should take from this, I think, is that the capitalist mode of production predominates, but it's not the only form of production in capitalist societies by any means. So capitalism for Marx is a historical formation. It comes into being at a certain time, and its gradual emergence we can explain and research and so on. This key point about it being historical is important. It means both that there's a time before capitalism, obviously, and also then that there may be a time after it. So one of the things that Marx tries to do, I think, is to blow away the apparent kind of eternalization of capitalism, the sense in which the world that we live in is the only possible world that we could live in, which he says is one of the features of the ubiquity of capitalist forms. Marx gives considerable emphasis to some of the historically unprecedented features of capitalist society, which he sees as world historical and revolutionary. We'll look at this when we look at the Communist Manifesto particularly. But the sense is that capitalism basically is world-shaping, world-forming. It changes everything. So in that sense, it's tremendous revolutionary potentials are something that Marx and his long-term collaborator Engels emphasize in great detail. The opening sentences... opening sentences of the book are these. The wealth of societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails appears as an immense collection of commodities. The individual commodity appears as its elementary form. Our investigation therefore begins with the analysis of the commodity. A couple of features here. One of the best ways to see this is to look at the way in which capitalism looks or looks from the outside. If you look at 1989, for instance, and you see the way in which on the other side of the wall, people were viewing capitalism was precisely in terms of this idea as an immense collection of commodities. What the ending of historical communism would bring about was access to the proliferation of goods. Rather than just one set of clothes, for instance, or just one particular brand of jeans, a huge variety of stuff would become available. So that sense of but I want you to focus on the language here as well. They refer us obviously to the commodity itself, but also to the form in which in capitalist society that it appears. So immediately, once you start using this language of appears, or appears in both sentences, seems, and so on, we're encountering the suggestion that things as they seem, or as they are experienced, or even as they are given to us, might actually be the forms of appearance of something else. So it seems this way, but there's a suggestion, this is a depth model that Marx is using. It's a hermeneutics. Something is happening on the surface, but something is happening underneath the surface. Marx is one of the great masters of suspicion, if you like. Often in the history of philosophy or of social thought, a number of these of these people who think this kind of way are mentioned. Nietzsche is often used as a counterexample. Above all, Freud is used. Freud uses a depth model, doesn't he, when he speaks of the layer, if you like, of the conscious. But underneath it, there's all this other stuff that is taking place. And what's the relationship between those two levels or two moments? Is one the truth and the other one somehow just its appearance, or what exactly is happening in that relationship? The same thing I think in Marx. So when Harvey comes to write about this, he says something else is going on beneath the surface appearance. Marx writes in the chapters that we're looking at today, every product of labor is a social hieroglyphic. Everything that's made is a social hieroglyphic. What does he mean? Why does he say that? What's going on there? That's, I think, what we need to try and unpack. Let's start, if we can, with the idea of the commodity itself. What Marx says is a commodity appears at first sight an extremely obvious, trivial thing. And we need to start with that point. Commodity is simply a thing that has been made. It's a product. So any product that you'd want to, I have this one to hand, so it's a product, it's a commodity. As a product, it satisfies a need. Therefore, he says it has a use value. The use value of the clock is how well it tells time. That's not difficult. The magnitude of use value, in other words, how much use value there is in the product, depends on the quality both of the materials used and on the labor expended. That is on the quality of the work that takes these materials and transforms them into a given product. How good is the work done? The sense in which if you're asking about a watch, you would ask about its precision, about its longevity, about the quality of the materials that it finds. That's all at the level of use values, and that's the first point to be made. So Marx writes that a specific kind of productive activity is required to bring use values into existence. If you're a watchmaker, you have been trained in those particular resources. You have certain skills which are the product of a certain kind of education, a certain kind of training, etc. All of this is very obvious, I suppose. So Marx says this activity is determined by its aim, its mode of operation, its object, its means, and its result. All of this at the level of use values. So the work that makes use values is purposive, it's goal-directed, it's instrumental, it's qualitative, it's particular, it's irreducible, it's commensurable only with similar kinds of work. You can at the level of use values, you can ask a question as to whether, let's say, a Rolex is a better clock than that. At the level of use values, that's a meaningful question, obviously. So a table made by a carpenter, this table or the table that you're sitting at, can be compared with another table made by a different carpenter. Go into this. Here we have on the right the food served at a local greasy spoon, fish and chips, etc., etc. On the left, a meal produced by René Redzepi at Noma Restaurant in Copenhagen, consistently rated the best restaurant in the world over the past 6, 7, 8 years. So £150 for that dish, which is actually only an hors d'oeuvre. Pumpkin, kelp, beechnut, caviar, it is. So at the level of use values, that question which is better can be asked, but you can already see by the fact that I've given you the prices that that in some sense something else is going to come in to determine this, not use values. The labor that makes them all is specific, irreducible, purposive, instrumental, etc. That in other words, these foods, these dishes satisfy needs. You're hungry, so you go to a restaurant. But obviously something else is taking place there, or else you would always go to this one rather than that one, wouldn't you? It's the something else that Marx is particularly interested in. So what a carpenter produces, obviously, can't be measured or compared in use-value terms with what René Redzepi produces, by definition. It would make no sense at the level of use-values. I mean, let's look at this. At the level of use-values, that equation makes no sense. The labor that makes the table is specific, purposive, instrumental, goal-directed. The labor that makes the food is exactly the same, but they're different kinds of labor. The use values are entirely different. I mean, can you speak of those at the level? You can't compare them at the level of use values. This food is better than that table. What would that even mean? So at the level of use values, things seem very clear. For exchange to take place, it must obviously be possible for the value of one commodity to be expressed in terms of that of another commodity, which is completely different. So at the level of exchange, you must be able to somehow compare those two things. You can see that at the level of use values, you can't do that. So a second kind of value is discussed by Marx here. So costs the same as is what I'm referring to here. Small Persian carpet costs the same as a smartphone. A bottle of wine has the same exchange value as three rolls of tin foil or two pairs of tennis socks. Which can only mean that there has been an equalization or a rendering equivalent, or at least a rendering comparable, of the various qualities embodied in these commodities. I've already said what use value requires. Exchange requires a completely different set of operations. It requires an abstract quantitative measure. In exchange, qualitative factors are homogenized, departicularized, and rendered comparable. Here's the way Marx describes this. If X boot polish, the number, let's say, you know, two tins, Y silk, Z gold must be exchanged, that is, be mutually replaceable or identical magnitude. That's the key point. It follows the valid exchange values express something equal. And secondly, exchange value cannot be anything other than the form of expression. The form of appearance, he uses this word, Erscheinungsform, of a content distinguishable from it. So at the level of use values, you can't compare boot polish with silk or with gold. Yet they are constantly compared through having price tags attached to them. So, you know, two of this equals, has the same value as five of that. In order to make that kind of comparison, a notion of value must be available, must be socially available, which lets you do the exchange. Does that all make sense? We're just introducing this category of exchange value here. So as sensual beings, which we are with needs or with wants, and what's interesting, of course, is that Marx doesn't distinguish between needs or wants. He says that it doesn't make, it's of no consequence to me here, he says, whether we're talking about needs of the stomach, hunger, let's say, or wants of the fancy, the desire for a poem. That's not the issue. He's not saying that some needs are more primary or more elemental than others. He doesn't get into that discussion. In capitalist society, production and production as a whole is governed not by use value, but by exchange. If you think about this, we all know the logic. Buy. I mean, the key point being, in fact, if you think about the production of needs, when I was a child, I admit it was the late 15th century, but even so, I had two pairs of sneakers. I had tennis shoes, and what in South Africa we called tackies, which were just walking shoes, right? That was it. I was astonished in my sort of 20s, 30s, 40s to discover the proliferation of new needs, the fact that things that had not existed before, so running shoes, cross trainers, what happens here is the production of new needs. This market works, always that with the notion of buying. You need these things. They're on them. You need to obtain them, etc. etc. It's also the case, of course, that from the person who commands that commodity, that is to say, not usually the direct producer. And we know that sneakers are 80% or 90% of sneakers are made in various different outsourced destinations. So not the direct producers, but the is this a Nike? So the executives of Nike, from their standpoint, obviously, the use value is only the bet, since commodities are made to be exchanged. So that Marx insists, and we'll look at this because things may have changed. He insists that in some sense. If you think about the value of those, let's say they cost £200, Marx argued that obviously is something that we're talking about as exchange value, but use value is embodied in that you wouldn't buy a pair of sneakers even if they were branded, would you, if they had no use at all. I think this is a limit case. It might be, for instance, that you buy a Lamborghini not to use it at all, but to be seen to have it. Why do you buy the most, why would you splash out a fortune on Jimmy Choo shoes, for instance? I mean, when the last thing presumably you'd want to do is to actually to consume them, that is to say, to ruin them through use. The point about these shoes is that you want them to be seen to have them so that you actually don't use them at all. You don't use up their use value. So that maybe Marx Marx insists that they have to be usable. Refrigerators, even if they're branded, have to keep things cold. They still have to have that use value in them, he suggests, or else they couldn't be exchanged. But their exchange value has nothing to do with their use value. It isn't that Jimmy Choo shoes are better than Nikes or better than the kind of the simple forms that might be made much, much more cheaply. That they may be, but it's not their price which tells you that they're better at the level of use values. If you continue this further, what exactly is a lifestyle center was the blurb that I read here. Is it just a dressed-up shopping mall? What you begin to hear is the fact that exchange value governs the forms of appearance of life, in some sense, that we live to shop rather than something else here. From the standpoint of the manufacturer, you could say, if you're being cynical, it's a matter of indifference whether, having been bought, the goods that have been manufactured are used or not. From the standpoint of the manufacturer who wants to sell her or his product, it's of no consequence whether we actually use them. In fact, from the standpoint of a manufacturer, it might be better if we lost the shoes on the way home, because then we'd have to go and buy another pair. So using is nothing to do with the calculus of production. They are produced to be exchanged. They are produced to be sold. They are not produced to be used. This is what Marx means when he says that in capitalist society, production for exchange overrides production for use. Use value, as we've seen, is tied to the materiality of the object. So usefulness does not dangle in mid-air, he says. It's conditioned by the physical properties of the commodity. The use values of the clock are a function of its of the metals, of the quartz, of the crystals, etc., etc. You can't take those away and the product has no use value. But that isn't the exchange value. Exchange value is relational. So Noma versus McDonald's. It's a relational exchange there. It's a purely social concept. It's conventional, as Marx puts it. Marx describes use value as the plain, homely, natural form of commodities. Let me just alert you to the question that we might want to ask. Does Marx have a notion, do you think, of a kind of natural value? Is that a kind of a in some sense, a sort of essentialism in Marx? Does that operate? Is it something which you would say, in his theory of use value, is there some sense of a sort of naturalness? Is there an ethical charge attached to that category in his philosophy? I mean, we can deal with that question later on in the module as well. So if use value is plain and homely and so on, he then, when he comes to discuss exchange value, he says we can twist and turn a single commodity as we wish, twist it, open it up, see what's inside it, etc. It remains impossible to grasp it as a thing possessing exchange value. You can't look at the properties of the thing, even if it's got gold. You can't look at the properties of the thing and find out what its exchange value is. Because as we know, the attachment of a swoosh, for instance, or a branded name, is not something that's inside the product. It's not something that is part of its use values. It's a different notion of value. However, let us remember that commodities possess an objective character as values only insofar as they're all expressions, says Marx, of an identical social substance, which is human labor. Their objective character is therefore purely social. So that what produces exchange value is purely social for Marx. It's nothing natural at all. He'll use this term that's very complicated later on, socio-natural, but we'll come back to that because it's obviously a complicated term, that one. So from this, he says, it follows self-evidently, it can only appear in the social relation between commodity and commodity. So that's an extraordinary formulation, the idea that there is a social relation between commodity and commodity. Not only between two alike commodities, two forms of food, for instance, Noma and McDonald's, but between this clock and McDonald's. A social relation obtains between two commodities that obviously has no existence at the level of use values at all. So what then is commodity fetishism? Marx speaks of the false semblance, the false alikeness, that is established when the thing in which the magnitude of the value of another thing is represented appears to have the equivalent form independently of this relation as a social property inherent in its nature. So if you just think of the transcoding of commodities into money, the idea of the price tag, and how absolutely natural that seems to us. The idea that everything, as it were, comes with a price tag attached, and we read its value, which can only mean its exchange value, naturally off that relationship. So commodities conceal the form of value that they all have or share in common, which for Marx is the collective labor time necessary for their production. We don't need to get into that, I think. And they appear instead in the light of the fluctuating form of value that differentiates them on the market. I'm struck, for instance, to give you an example, my wife and I are thinking of downsizing, of moving. We live in North London, moving closer into the centre, where there are hospitals. This happens when you get older. It's only where there are hospitals. I used to be where there are theatres now. But anyway, so what's extraordinary is that we have a freestanding house with a garden. It has four bedrooms. We can move to a place closer into the centre of London, which has got 100 square metres. It's very small, 100 square metres of space. Two bedrooms maybe, no garden. And to do that, we could sell our place, and then we would have to raise a mortgage for another like £300,000 or £400,000. It's extraordinary. At the level of use values, it's meaningless. At the level of exchange values, what is it that makes a place in Hampstead, for instance, so much more valuable than the benighted place where we live, which is on the Green Belt and so on and so forth, quite nice, quite pretty. Just that sense in which you get a worse place at the level of use values, smaller, maybe more modern, etc., but objectively worse for much, much more money. Use value, exchange value. That's what's being described there. So Marx wants to show us how the mystifying aspect of commodities has nothing to do with their use value. All use values derive ultimately from the expenditure of ordinary human exertion. There's nothing strange about it. Nor is it strange that commodities all share a certain measure of labor time. Obviously, labor time under certain conditions is what makes commodities. So what's so strange about commodities for him is that they take on a life of their own. That life seems to have nothing to do with their physical properties as objects. This particular flat with no land versus that one which is a house with land. And yet that's nothing to do with their exchange value. So they become paradoxically, in the process, he suggests, commodities become agents rather than things. They become subjects rather than objects. They become the drivers of a social world rather than the vehicles or the tools of a humanly made system. They convert quality of experience, quality of materials, into quantity, how much, size, all without question, all without apparent question from us. So to fetishize is obviously to invest something with powers that it does not intrinsically possess. Marx is taking that definition. Of course, the word fetishism is getting a tremendous new lease of life at the time that Marx is writing. If you think of how it's used in the colonial experience to describe magical kind of superstitions, voodoo and so on, the term fetishism often used there. Investing in a colonialist sense, Marx is not using it in that sense. They're the keys to modern capitalism for Marx. He begins his book with them, and people have often wondered, why does he begin with the commodity form? Why does he begin? I mean, it's a 3,000-page text overall. Why does he start with this notion of the fetishism of the commodity? And it's because they represent the end products of a convoluted process in which use values are subsumed by exchange value. Social relations are subsumed by object relations. So relations between people are subsumed by relations between products in the marketplace. That's the key point here. Two things are happening. The one is a kind of substitution of exchange for use. The other is a kind of inversion. Ultimately, what Marx is describing is a process in terms of which goods circulating on the market or in the world, products, seem to have a social life. They talk to each other. They're chatting endlessly. Actually, the best place to see this, of course, is in advertisements. Advertisements are so stunningly keyed, aren't they, to the kind of the changing pulse of the times. But if you think of how often in advertisements two products start talking to each other, and in that process, he suggests, we, who are the makers of those products, are objectified as the mere sort of echoes of them. So that something happens to us too. We become actually the objects of those objects, is what Marx is suggesting. So there's an occlusion, if you like, of the social character of private labor and the social relations between individual producers. Commodities seem to enter the world without bearing the traces of their collective production. You go into a shop, there's a price tag, and you respond immediately to that price tag. You say, oh, £12. It's worth it or it isn't worth it, you say. But in some strange way, it's worth it or it's not worth it. Commuting in your head exchange value language or the code of exchange value into the code of use value, as though that happens. So it would be worth it at £12. It's not worth it at £15. Two social codes, two ways of talking, if you like, use and exchange, are somehow coming together as though that's a natural development. It's not at all natural historically. That would have been a meaningless kind of thought process to somebody in the 15th century. Even though, of course, in the 15th century there were commodities. But this is why Marx emphasizes the idea of commodities, of what happens when the mode of commodity production becomes the dominant one in society, not an accidental one, not one at the level of the market or at the level of luxury goods, but becomes the kind of the universal language of commerce, of intercourse between people. So the mysterious character, I think this is a quote, oh sorry, this is Jean Baudrillard, who we're not looking at this term, but if you're interested in this development of consumer society in some way, he's one of the more important people to look at. So shopping, flirting with objects. I mean, that idea of flirting with objects is very interesting, because obviously when we flirt with them, we either we subjectify them, or else we objectify ourselves. One of those two things has to happen. Idle wandering and all the permutations of these. Baudrillard is very sensitive to the idea that it's in the late 60s, early 70s that massive amounts of energy are spent into developing kind of wall-to-wall shopping centres. I mean, in France, in the early 70s, shopping centres are introduced where you check it. They've got a hotel on site, and so you go through the doors. Often they're opaque from the outside, so you go into another world. And inside that world, all you do is shop. You can stay overnight, as it were, so that you don't break the illusion. You go into them to flirt with objects, etc. It's just an endless kind of cycling of goods, and you stay overnight. You spend a whole weekend in the shopping centre. This was a project just sort of tried out in France in the 70s. So the mysterious character of the commodity form consists, therefore, simply, not so simple, the commodity reflects the social characteristics of men's own labour as objective characteristics of the products of labour themselves. And this is that term, as the socio-natural properties of these things. So two things to be mentioned about this, the social characteristic of people's own labour. The one is, of course, the conditions of production that make something are not available to us. Go back to those Nike sneakers. We all know about the kind of questions of sweatshops and so on, but that is not available in the price. £150, bang. Social characteristics of men's labour are invisible at the level of exchange value. But also, of course, the sense in which our own lives our own lives as productive citizens rather than as consumptive ones gets kind of obliterated there. So there are two things taking place. That term socio-natural is difficult. He seems to be suggesting, doesn't he, that in the sphere of exchange, which is increasingly dominant or constitutive of life in the round, what is real is seen to correspond to the movement of goods on the market. That's what's real. All else is merely second order. So think about we're thinking about the seeming naturalness, the socio-natural quality, the idea of paying cash for food. This systematizes that social relationship that I was describing, because of course, think about, never mind the food itself, that is a much more complicated story. How was it produced? Where was it produced? Under what circumstances? How did it get to Tesco or to Sainsbury? But just think of how complicated is your own acquisition of the money. Where did that come from? How much do you have? What happened? But just it's the apparent naturalness that you pay out your money with all of that sense of... Of course, you know how much money you have if you don't have much of it. You go up to the till and you say, oh, I can only afford 40 quid or something like that. And they are very conscious of the fact of that, you know, this is all you have, and perhaps you've had to work quite hard to get that £40, etc., etc. But by and large, that's not the way in which we approach a till. We have enough money. Very often, of course, we don't even have money. It's the that's not my label, by the way. I don't actually think they are particularly cute, but anyway, but there they are, paying for their food, smiling, happy. With the credit card. And think of that notion of what credit involves here. I mean, just and how we don't think of that fact, hence their smiling happiness. the apparent obviousness of the socio-natural properties here that are described. The equivalence between money and the objects it purchases. That's what exchange value is. Somehow £20 is equivalent to all of those cabbages and lamb chops or whatever it is that you've bought. How weird is that? That idea that this is the equivalent, this is the right price or something, the right value. I mean, it's just such a strange relationship. It's the sheer strangeness of it that gets forgotten. That's what Marx is most interested in here. So commodity fetishism then involves an inversion in which one readily understandable social logic, the level of use, based on the social intercourse of people as makers and users of those youth values in specific relationships at the site of production, is supplanted by another corresponding to exchange value, which is based on exchange, the circulation of goods, including, of course, human beings in their capacity as labor power in the marketplace. So what's involved is a supplanting or even a disappearing or forgetting. This is a concept that we're going to take up next week when we look at reification, thingification. A kind of forgetting is involved. And Harvey writes about this, doesn't he? Marx's language suggests that in the process, second nature overwrites nature. I've always been struck by this word, second nature. If you say something is second nature to you, what does it mean? It means it's not natural, but it has become as though natural. Isn't that what the term means? And that's very close to what he seems to understand by fetishism here. It's that sense in which something which isn't natural is so obvious, is so universally apparent, etc., etc., that it becomes obvious. That's second nature for him. So what is socially constructed or mediated, credit card for cabbage, begins to seem immediate, or given at least. It's the obvious form. And our notice how well we speak this language. The fact that we don't always find ourselves tripped up by the process. We speak this language absolutely fluently, which is a sign of our immersion in that particular cultural logic. What's given begins to seem socially constructed by virtue of causes become effects and effects become causes. So as Harvey writes here, when you go into the supermarket, you can find out the exchange values, £10, £5, etc. But you can't see or measure the human labour embodied in the commodities directly. It's that embodiment of human labour that has a phantom-like presence on the supermarket shelves. Here's Frederick Jameson, a long quote. I'm talking about the same process. It's the sense of the. It's not only that forgetting, effacement of the traces of production, it happens. There's a sense in which politically it often seems to be necessary. As Jameson puts it, you don't want to have to think about third world women every time you pull yourself up to your word processor or all the other lower class people with their lower class lives when you decide to use or consume your other luxury products. It would be like having voices inside your head. Indeed, it violates the intimate space of your privacy and your extended body. For a society that wants to forget about class, therefore fetishism is very functional indeed. This is this argument about the kind of forgetting that's involved, and we'll see more, talk more about that later on in the module, as well as today. Very obviously, we've seen these kinds of things before: luxury chocolate ganache gift box, $24.95. As distinct from the bittersweet way of life in Ghana itself, earnings at £3 a day. Something. I mean, that's what, according to Jameson and Harvey, is forgotten in the mere paying over of £24.95 for the chocolate box, or else on the right, each employee was given a biscuit and a cup of tea. There are mass laborers, notice female, mostly young, China this is, producing microchips or semiconductors for input into the smartphone. So we're talking about the massive amounts of congealed labor power that are involved in, you know, the fact that you can actually utilize that labor power with the smallest tip of your finger. It's quite extraordinary how much value is concentrated in that phone. And we see here look at the means of production. I don't mean the plant. I mean the organization, the social relations of production here that are involved. So tremendous amount of it's. We don't have access in any pricing to the social relations of production. It could be, of course, that the smartphone is made by, you know, by shiny, happy people who feel themselves. I mean, it isn't always that we're talking about exploitation or the massive kind of expropriation. It could be something completely. There could be farmers, milking cows that have plenty to eat and plenty of space to move in, etc., etc. And that's that when we buy the pint of milk, that's what's involved. But when, at the level of the price tag, none of these questions is readable. It's not that it's intentionally suppressed. It might be intentionally suppressed if you're looking at social conditions like this, but it doesn't need to be intentional. It's merely that exchange value doesn't have a depth here. Exchange value can't be read down to this level that is being described. So for Marx, this inversion isn't the result of illusion or error. I mean, it isn't as though you can smack yourself on the head and say, wait a minute, I'm going to go from there to there, and so on. That isn't what's involved. It can't be corrected theoretically. So it represents, he says, the actual mode of appearance of the real world. When Marx begins with the world of capitalist society presents itself as a giant accumulation of stuff, you can read below the surface. That's what Marx is doing. But you can't, by reading below the surface, it doesn't change the way things are. That's how they are given to us. That is the logic of capitalist society, he suggests. It can't be corrected. On the contrary, as he puts it, it represents the actual mode of appearance of the real world. So that in capitalist society, as he puts it, the definite social relations between people assumes for them the fantastic form of a relation between things. It's astonishing. So that there the social relations of production appears to us as a social relation between things, of which we are one. We might be an important one, etc., but we are one. So it's not because people are deluded or mystified. It's because in capitalist society, the defining social relations between people are thing-like, Marx suggests. He uses this word dinglich, thing-like. It is because the social relations appear as what they are, not as direct social relations between persons in their work, but rather as material, dinglich, relations between persons and social relations between things. Think about that. Material relations, or objective, object-like relations between persons, social relations between things. I'm thinking of those advertisements again in which commodities talk. Marx is particularly interested in the idea that the idea of commodities talking to each other, which of course is to socialize commodities, to give them a social life. And in fact, their social life seems to be incredibly rich. Commodities are happy talking to each other. They have full lives. Our lives, by comparison, seem to be relatively reduced unless we can afford to buy the commodities. We're on the outside in some ways. We would like to be able to participate in the conversations between things. But what does that mean? How could that possibly happen? So here he is making that point that I've just made. So by no means banishes the semblance of objectivity possessed by the social characteristics of labor. And he makes the point about the historical specificity of capitalism here. So if we're talking about this as fetishism involves an inversion, a kind of a substitution a forgetting. There are a whole series of ways in which if the world seems upside down, so that commodities have a life and we don't, or we only have it through our participation, then that's a kind of inversion. But it's also a substitution of the language of use gets substituted somehow by exchange. It also involves a forgetting of the conditions of labor. All of those things seem to be involved in this process he's describing. Not because we're mistaken, but because that's how things are, he suggests. So critiquing that fetishism can't content itself with merely pointing out that in ideology, things seem upside down. If you look at the ways in which, so here's the, obviously, when the tough, going gets tough, the tough go shopping, that sense of the idea of shopping till you drop, as an appropriate form of, I mean, it's a joke, obviously, but it's an appropriate, as though this was, in some sense, us expressing ourselves fully. We are most ourselves when we're shopping, is the logic here. Shop till you drop, it just makes sense. That from the standpoint of Marx is interested, isn't he, in defamiliarizing, in making strange. And so if you read Marx and you think, actually, it doesn't make sense at all. It's the opposite of sense. That's, in some ways, what he's trying to do. You probably know Banksy's great, terrifying, actually, take on this shop till you drop. And here we have, obviously, that happening. The sense of this involves not the making of your life, but the losing of it. That's obviously the one critique. So Marx is examining the surrealism of life under modern capitalism, what Walter Benjamin will term the phantasmagoria of 19th century society. Strange things happen. Look at Marx's language. So the tables are stepping forward, you know, they're turning upside down, they're thinking wooden thoughts. Objects are invisibly stamped with an undecodable logic. People relate to one another through the medium of things. It's as though you can read this as a novel, in some sense, in which case it becomes a novel by Dickens, if you think about this. So the grotesquerie is intrinsic to Victorian society. We have a place where objects appear animated, humans are merely cogs in a machine, people are reduced to the functions of a body part or an accessory, buildings or institutions assume the character of most things. So what's happening here is a kind of a defamiliarization, a making strange. You know the Russian concept. Well, this is, of course, is one of the things that modernist art attempts to do, is to make strange. Think of that Russian term. I'm not quite sure how it should be pronounced. Does anyone speak Russian? Is it ostranieni? I don't know, anyway. But encouraging people to see common things as strange, wild, or unfamiliar, defamiliarizing what is known, you ought to know it differently or more. Think of the new techniques introduced into art here. The slow motion, the close-up, the microscope. All of these things seem in some way to disturb. So Marx Marx is doing something very particular, but he's also of his time in introducing these categories. So the task is to seize on the apparently trivial and simple aspects of modern life, buying a spool of thread or a bottle of vinegar, etc., and show that what appears simple is both profoundly complex and revelatory. Let me stop. I hope that's a good start. I mean, the main thing is to get us to think that what seems obvious. Marx is a critic of the naturalness, of the apparent naturalness of everyday life. Above all, what strikes us as common sense with the force of obviousness is what he tries to say is not obvious at all.